Mike. Thanks for having me. So this is we're staying with the Fourier theme for a moment, trying to see whether Fourier transform can actually buy us something for quantum algorithms. And ideally, we'd like to get, of course, exponential speedups for something. And well, several people believe this area of hidden shift problems is an area where you can expect such speedups. As you will see in a moment, you can't always get it, but in some cases we can get it, and we try to get our head around when can we expect speedups. Mainly it's in query complexity. For some problems, we can get even a time-efficient algorithm. So roughly, I want to motivate the problem very briefly and then present three approaches to you. It's kind of a mixed bag in this talk. I don't know a good way to unify them yet, but maybe there is a way. The first one is basically we try to leverage correlations, like in good old Fourier analysis. Second one is more like you just sample from the spectrum and then you try to do as good as you can. And the third one is a recent development. It's jointly with Maurice and Andrew and Jeremy. I'm giving credits in several parts of the talk, so stay tuned. And I want to do like 10 minutes of Q&A. Please interrupt me anytime, though. Let's not do it at the end. Let's do it on the fly. Okay, so Fourier transform, everybody knows, in the period finding task, you set up a state which is periodic or almost periodic, like in Pavel's case, and then you have this annoying thing that there might be some offset which you'd like to get rid of. And how to get rid of it? Well, Fourier transform that state. You again get a state that looks periodic, maybe with a different period, but hopefully that new period is related somehow to your original period. Then you sample from this guy and do some classical post-processing to infer what the period was. So that idea has been used in several contexts. It's a very powerful idea. It works even if that's not such a nice lattice structure, even if the period is kind of broken a little bit. Like I don't fully understand all that number theory stuff, but to me, it means that you don't have a perfectly periodic structure. Nevertheless, you can Fourier transform it and you get enough information from sampling that from these states. Or in the hidden radius problem, you don't get like subspace, you get some other structure, maybe an algebraic structure. By Fourier transforming, now you have to work harder to figure out where this thing is actually concentrated. And you don't always get polynomial algorithms, but the idea is to get rid of these offsets that are so annoying. They go into phase information. You don't feel that when you measure. Right? So that's nice, but really it would be nice if we could use another property of the Fourier transform, namely convolution property. That's a very powerful tool classically. So if you want to compute the convolution between two functions, instead of doing that kind of naively by a quadratic algorithm, classically, the preferred way to do it is first computing the Fourier transform of the first vector, then of the second vector, computing the pointwise product of the Fourier transforms, and computing the inverse Fourier transform. Right? It's very well known that this is a way to compute that convolution. And classically, that leads to an n log n algorithm. That's very nice. And quantumly, the Fourier transforms are basically for free, right? They're like log n square or whatever. That's, maybe you can do it even faster, maybe in n log n, or maybe even in log n, log log n, sorry. Maybe even faster. But the thing is, it's almost for free, right? Fourier transform is almost instantaneous on a quantum computer. So why not use that trick to do convolutions? And if we can do convolutions, we can correlate stuff, and that should be very powerful in principle, right? Maybe we can just do that for a fixed function, but it would be good enough because our fixed function could be sort of a template, and we want to find that template in a larger vector. Right? The whole question is, of course, how does the vector get into the memory? But maybe there's another mechanism which prepares our memory with a state, and we want to correlate it with some target vector. Any questions up to that point? Okay, so of course there's an issue with that approach, and the issue is exactly this pointwise multiplication, right? Everything else is unitary, all the DFTs are unitary, but the pointwise multiplication is in general not unitary. Actually, we can say exactly when it is unitary. It's unitary if and only if the spectrum of this function g here is perfectly flat, right? As soon as you have a non-flat spectrum, you cannot do that with a diagonal unitary matrix anymore. And so you just cannot use this algorithm. The question is, can we maybe still use the idea, but just modify it appropriately? So one very straightforward idea is, if it's not flat, why don't we just renormalize it? make it flat, right? Divide each Fourier coefficient by its magnitude, by its absolute value. That will give us a new function. Can we maybe just plug that function in here and see how good we're doing? Right? That's a very naive idea. But as we will see, that in some sense, it's kind of already the best that's possible. I want to make that more precise in that talk. But first, I want to show to you a class of functions for which actually there is a perfectly flat spectrum. It's kind of an interesting class of functions from the classical combinatorics perspective and from the crypto perspective. It's there where these functions have been studied. Okay, but let me give you first the formal definition of the problem, what the hidden shift problem is. So you have a group. It's typically in this talk an abelian, finite abelian group. One can define these problems for some non-abelian groups too. And people have done that. In this talk, it's mainly abelian, and mainly it's just the hypercube, the Boolean hypercube. That's mainly what I'm interested in here. You're given a promise, namely that the two functions you're given, think of the functions as being given by oracles. So you can query them, and it will cost you, right? Every question you ask to the oracle will cost you. And you can query them in superposition if you like, but you have to account for these queries. You get the additional promise that there is such a shift, such that all the inputs x, the function g is given by just dilating x by that shift s, right? So as soon as you know s, you will the function g is completely determined from the function f. But of course, by just looking at some random evaluation points of f and g, it's very unlikely that you will be able to figure out what the shift is. Maybe information theoretically, there might be maybe enough information in there if you're lucky and you know your function f very well. But if both f and g are pretty much unknown, then you're just poking around. You're not learning much from querying these two functions. Okay. So why is this interesting? Well, there's one context in which an algorithm existed for a long time, actually. It's by Van Damme, Hallgren, and Ip. They showed that for a certain number theoretic function, this so-called Legendre symbol, you can identify such an S from very few queries to F. Actually, one query is enough, right? So you only have to look one time at the function and one time at the shifted function, so to speak, and you will figure out the shift S. That's nice. And of course, the question is, can we find other such problems for which we can do a similar thing? In particular, since there's a big overlap between these two fields, if you look at all possible shift problems, the set of all shift problems has a pretty big overlap with the set of all hidden subgroup problems. Because now you have to kind of relax the definition. You have to allow non-abelian groups on the hidden subgroup side, right? So, and it makes it more non-abelian. If you start with an abelian hidden shift problem, the corresponding hidden subgroup problem will be for a non-abelian group. If you start with a cyclic group, the hidden shift problem over the cyclic group, it will translate into a hidden subgroup problem for the dihedral group. So that's kind of bad. We try to stay away from big cyclic groups as much as possible. It's kind of why we look at the hypercube, which is just a bunch of small Z2s. But nevertheless, the problem is non-trivial even for these groups. Hopefully, we can use that someday to attack maybe a crypto system or so. But these hopes have not panned out so far. All right, so let me show you some examples. So maybe the most simple example is just take f to be a delta function. Okay, it's zero everywhere, it's one at one point. The domain doesn't really matter in that case. It could be the hypercube, it could be the integers mod n. Then identifying the shift is nothing but searching in a list with 2 to the n elements. So we have we know that's kind of, there's a tight bound for that. We cannot do better than square root of 2 to the n. So for that, that's kind of an extremal case of a hidden shift problem over an abelian group. Pick your group as nice as you want. Take it as to be the hypercube. Still, you will not be able to do it better than with square root of 2 to the n points. On the other hand, there's this mentioned problem of the Legendre symbol. In that case, the group is different. It's not the hypercube or the integer. It's the multiplicative group in a finite field of characteristic p. And the function is very specific. It's a plus minus one function, and it detects whether you're given x as a square or a non-square. At zero, you define it to be zero. So the nice thing about that function is that its Fourier transform is the function itself. If you take, it's kind of an eigenfunction of the Fourier transform. And since it's a plus minus one function, except for that one annoying point, but let's forget about that, we essentially have a flat spectrum. Right? That function is a flat spectrum. And that's the reason why a correlation approach will actually work. So that's basically the underlying reason. The question is, can we find other such functions which have a pretty flat spectrum, or maybe ideally completely flat spectrum, for which we then could do the same trick? As I said, mainly in this talk, everything is Boolean. Okay, so let me show you the first kind of idea, which it's exactly the idea from that paper. It's a simple algorithm which will query f once and g once and will determine that s with certainty. That algorithm will always produce s. There's no error. And there's no don't care or don't know answer. So you run the algorithm. At the end of the day, you will have s with certainty. So how does it work? You start with a zero state. Then you prepare the equal superposition of all inputs. You query the shifted function. And then you Fourier transform it. Now, if you have a function that's shifted and you look at the spectrum, then the spectrum of the original function is related to that. It's just like a phase. A linear phase gets picked up in the Fourier transform. If the Fourier transform of G is nothing but the Fourier transform of F times this linear phase. The linear phase, of course, depends exactly on that S by which you shift it. All right? So what you can do now is, well, we'd like to get rid of this now, right? This is annoying. It's still hanging around. We'd like to get rid of it. How can you get rid of it? Well, let's uncompute it. So you need the Fourier transform of F. This is the pointwise multiplication that I mentioned in the beginning. So you need that to get rid of that component. In the case of the Legendre symbol, well, it's an eigenfunction. So you just apply again the Legendre symbol. The other functions for which the Fourier transform is not the function itself, obviously, right? But there are cases where it's also flat. In fact, I'm going to show you in a minute a few such examples. But for any such example, you can just kill that component, and you get one of the columns of the Fourier transform. You do another Fourier transform, and you get S back. Then you measure S, and you get the answer. A very simple algorithm. And of course, it's crucial that you can uncompute the you can get rid of the Fourier coefficient F hat of W here. So let me show you a class of functions for which it's possible to do it perfectly flat. And it's kind of nice because it's related to combinatorics, crypto, a little bit of group theory also. There's a whole theory of such functions. They're called, in the classical world, they're called bent functions. Maybe bent because they're very far away from linear or affine functions. They're kind of very crooked, like this guy maybe. So they have the property to have a perfectly flat spectrum. In that case, it's known that you must have that n is even. It don't exist if you have an odd number of variables. And of course, if you have such a function, because of the flatness, the only possible spectral coefficients are plus 1 and minus 1. Because we take the Walsh-Hadamard spectrum, it's a plus minus 1 matrix. The function is also plus minus 1. So the coefficients can only be plus minus 1, that number. So if you have such a thing, you can implicitly define a new function, namely by just picking up that phase. That's called sometimes the dual. And by taking the dual twice, you get the function back. So there's a large class of such functions called Majorana-McFarland class. It's a pretty big class of functions. It roughly has 2 to the n to the power square root 2 to the n functions. It's of course, much less than the total number of Boolean functions. But it's a relatively large class of functions. And here's an example of a function from that class. And as you see, the Fourier transform is, again, perfectly flat. So any questions up to that point? Of course, you might ask, like, how do I find more such examples of such functions? And is it pretty generic? If I pick a function at random, will it be flat or will it be far away from that? It turns out if you pick a function at random, so you pick all the function, you pick a plus minus one function at random, right, that's your function f, and you look at the Fourier transform, then its spectrum will be quite flat. With high probability, you will never have the case that most of your Fourier coefficients are, say, zero or close to zero. It will maybe look like this. It will oscillate a lot, but if you clip it somehow here, you will find that, like, most of the Fourier coefficients will be concentrated around, say, 1 over square root of 2 to the n, give or take. So if you put a little interval around it, you can get it in that interval with very high probability. All right, so essentially we're looking for functions for which the Fourier transform is roughly of the same size. So you're looking for objects for which the start object is roughly of the same size as the object. Sorry, I couldn't resist. So this is a one such class in the Boolean case. It's essentially inner product of two vectors of length n. Take a vector, x here stands for vector of variables, x1 to xn. Y is another vector. And you can apply any permutation of the binary strings of length n to it, to that vector here, and define a function that way. That g here can be any function that depends on just a second set of variables. Right? So that should give you an idea that there's a huge class of functions because you have a huge number of permutations to choose from. So it turns out any such function has a perfectly flat spectrum. And the proof is very simple. You can just like work out what happens to these characters. It turns out you get a flat spectrum. And you can actually say, in that case, quite nicely, what is that dual band function? In general, it's not so easy to say what the dual band function is. And as a matter of fact, there are some classes where I don't know. It's possible to write down what the original function is in a nice fashion. But the dual might be quite messy. There's, for instance, one class depending on certain Clusterman sums. And for that, I don't know the dual, for instance. Another class uses some affine lines in a Galois field. And like it depends on balanced functions and affine lines. For that, there is a nice notion for the dual. But for these Clusterman guys, for instance, I don't know a nice way to compute a dual. Okay, the algorithm is very simple, as I said. You first do Hadamard transform, evaluate the function into the phase. Hadamard transform, then you uncompute the Fourier transform. You do the Hadamard transform, and you get S back. And the question now is, what can we do if it's not perfectly flat? So the rest of the talk will deal with that case pretty much. What can we do if it's not a band function? If some of the Fourier coefficients are less than 1 over square root of n, what can we do? So in a paper by Dave Meyer and a student of his, they proposed if it's not flat, then you just renormalize the spectrum and take that as the correlator out here. Okay, just plug that thing out here and then see how good you can do. Unfortunately, that leads to big distortions because if these coefficients are very small, then you amplify them by a lot, right? By dividing it by the absolute value, you're kind of giving them a lot more power, maybe more than they deserve.
Is there a small circuit which does that normalization at all?
That's just a query result. We just want to have any transformation that does it at that point. We assume we have perfect knowledge about G. We can do whatever pre-processing we can do. Just come up with anything. It doesn't even have to be a diagonal unitary. It could be any unitary here. And then how well can we do in identifying S, maximizing over all such unitaries? Yeah, that's a very good question. People ask that same question, it turns out, in different contexts. For instance, in optics, it turns out people studied exactly that question because they wanted to find a way so that their optical computer computes the convolution. So they can put any element here, and any element is really any diagonal matrix. It can be even non-unitary matrices if you allow like absorption here. But it turns out if you want to have a lot of energy at the output, you better use a glass plate so that it's just a phase modification. So that algorithm optically is exactly the same algorithm as this algorithm because you have an incoming wave. These two gates prepare like an incoming wave front. Then you do a Fourier transform, your phase plate, and then your Fourier transform. And it's nothing what this here does. You have your incoming wave, you do your Fourier transform, the pointwise multiplication, and then another Fourier transform, then you have the convolution. So classically, people like develop algorithms to compute these phase plates. And there's some heuristics around. There's a so-called iterative Fourier transform algorithms. And for some time, I hope that maybe we can use the knowledge from that field and come up with new quantum algorithms. But I couldn't find anything that's kind of rigorous. It's a lot of engineering. And like, how do you initialize the iterative method? We use a random phase element. We do it in that way. Then we run the iterative algorithm. And then we get a phase plate. And it has that much throughput, okay, inside certain signal window. But I could never find any rigorous statement about, yeah, I get guaranteed that much energy, and it's that flat. I just couldn't. Maybe I didn't search long enough. But I couldn't find such statements. So we took a different approach. Let me maybe backtrack one step. So if the function is bent, we get a perfectly flat spectrum. If the function is, for instance, a delta function, we get a spectrum that looks like this. That's because, I mean, a delta function for us means really a function that's 1 everywhere and minus 1 exactly at one location s. If you take the Fourier transform of that, of course, you will get a very big peak here at 0 because it almost looks like the constant function. And then that one minus, that one thing pointing down gives you a plus or minus 1 pattern. But it's tiny compared to the size of the peak. Right? Essentially, we would have to correlate with such a guy if you wanted to do search. If you want to do a correlation-based search algorithm, we have to correlate using that guy. And that turns out to be very bad, actually. I don't think we get a speed up at all. Is that right? Like, if you do a correlation type algorithm for with a delta function, we don't get a square root of n algorithm for search, I think. We just get a n algorithm for search, if I remember correctly. Okay. Anyways, for the case of bent, we get an algorithm of complexity 1. Oh, okay, I put here square root of n. I'm actually not so sure about that. Should double check it. So, is it correct? Using the rejection method, though, right?
Well, that's right. Yes.
If I just plug in the element, I would get from the Myers.
Oh, yeah. No.
If I just plug in this guy, I probably don't get a speed up, right? But if I plug in the rejection sampling element, okay, good. Yeah. That's kind of the next step. Yeah, that's the next step to wrap it in. Like, what's the best way to kind of make amplitude amplification on that element to come up with the element? That's what this rejection sampling method will help us for. So quickly. In a nutshell, these two algorithms look kind of similar. The Grover algorithm and the algorithm for bent function, they apply a sequence of operators, and then you measure, you get your S. Right? In Grover, you do more iterations of that. But then again, it looks kind of the same. And one of the questions was, is there maybe more to that? It turns out, yes. So there's all these algorithms have that nature. They iterate, so operators of this kind. Okay, the question really is, you get a spectrum, how do we make it flat while still preserving the phase information, right? So that's important because the phase information has all the information about the shift S, but we'd like to get rid of this. So it's this annoying spectrum that's sitting on top of the character. We'd like to get rid of the spectrum, just replace it with this flat spectrum. So how can we stretch it out while we preserve that minus 1 to the W times S. In a sense, it's similar to a resampling task, right? Because you get a distribution, and you would really like to have another distribution. So classically, it would correspond to you have a distribution, probability distribution P, and suppose you can sample from it. But you would really like to sample from a different distribution. Let's call it S, right? So that problem actually occurs a lot in physics, because you might have a distribution that you even know beforehand, right? You know for each x, you know what is this p of x, but to actually produce a sample, this might be a quite costly procedure. Okay, so maybe you have the ability to sample from p of x, so you push a button, then it runs maybe for 5 minutes or so, and you get a sample here according to p of x. But you would really like to sample with a different probability distribution, namely s. So what you can do is, you can fit that distribution S under P. So you have to find a scaling factor so that all the points of S now fit under the whole distribution of P. Then you can flip a coin, or you generate a uniformly distributed variable on the interval 0, 1, right? So think of now of each of these, for each fixed X, think of that space here as the interval between 0 and 1. And now your coin might have fallen into that part or into that part. What you can do is you can say, I'm going to accept that sample x. I'm going to accept it if it falls under that curve. And I'm going to reject it if it's anywhere else here. You might not produce a sample if you do that, right? You run it, and maybe you fail, but then you just do it again. And it turns out that if you do that, then the probability to accept x is exactly given by this quotient here. But the probability to accept in one run. And the expected number of times you will have to do that is given by 1 over gamma. Okay, so the more you have to scale here, the longer it will take you in the worst case until you produce a sample. But at the end, you will sample exactly from the distribution S. So that's a way classically how you can morph probability distributions into each other. We'd like to do that quantumly now. So we have a distribution here. For us, a distribution looks like this. So it's a quantum state with some amplitudes which are completely known. The pi k are known. Like in the classical case, the distributions are known. Your k's, they're just basis states. But the thing that's unknown are these states, what's that letter? Xi k. And we don't even know what they are. They are entangled with our basis states k, but we don't know what these xi k's are. What we want to do is we want to change that state to a target state with different amplitudes, sigma k. Again, we know all the sigma k's. We want to have the same basis vector k's, and we want to preserve that state xi k. It's like preserving the phase before. A phase is nothing but a one-dimensional case here, right? If it's just a state, it corresponds to a phase. If it's one-dimensional, it's just a complex number. But it could be even a higher-dimensional quantum system entangled. And still, we want to go from here to here without knowing what that actually is. Is that possible at all? It turns out, yeah, it's possible. And the algorithm is very simple. So Maris is going to talk about that more tomorrow. I just want to give you a quick flavor so that we understand it for our context. So the idea is we have that state out here, right, where we start from. We want to map the pi's, essentially, we want to map them into sigmas. So what can we do? Well, we can attach an ancilla qubit. And depending on k, we can do a controlled rotation that rotates the pi to the sigma. Right? Of course, that cannot be done deterministically. So you do that rotation here. And then you kind of have to measure your ancilla system in the state 1. If you do that, then you succeeded. Right? Then you got the right state. If you don't measure it in the state 1, then it's just garbage. You have to throw the state away, and you have to repeat the experiment. But that's the idea, to kind of go from here to the target state by just applying these controlled rotations. And we assume in that context that we know the function f, all the Fourier coefficients, everything is known. All right, so if you do it for our context, where we have this function, we want to map it to the flat spectrum. We can work out what these rotations are. And then it turns out that the probability to measure 1, that means to accept, that's related to the 2 norm of that vector epsilon by which we have to rotate. Okay? And the overall complexity is given by 1 over the 2 norm of epsilon out here. So that gives us a way to relate the query complexity to find S to some properties of the Fourier spectrum. So if you know your minimal Fourier coefficient, you can plug it in here, and you see your query complexity of that algorithm. And now if you do it for the delta function, you indeed get a square root of 2 to the n algorithm. If you do it for a bent function, the minimal Fourier coefficient is 1 over square root of 2 to the n, so you get just a constant number of queries. Right, so that really interpolates between the bent function case and the search case. How much time do I have? Still positive?
Yeah, 15 minutes.
15 minutes, okay. That's great. Any questions about that algorithm? So you can see it like geometrically, it kind of corresponds to filling up the spectrum until a certain water level. The water level will determine your target probability to succeed. Right? So you want to find S with a certain probability in that case, maybe 0.9. And that will tell you a certain level up to which you have to fill the Fourier spectrum with water. And that water level is exactly that vector epsilon from the previous slide. This epsilon vector is exactly that water level vector. Right? I think probably Maris will say more about this tomorrow. But like the overall result in the context of the hidden shift problem is that we can say what the query complexity is of solving the hidden shift problem for a function f. We can relate it to the spectrum of f in this way. So take the spectrum, take this scaling factor gamma, and then you get this epsilon vector. So you have to fit kind of a flat spectrum under the originally given spectrum. And you're allowed to clip. Whenever there's a zero, you just clip it down. And you have to find the optimal gamma so you can reach your target probability P. P is the probability to find the overall shift. And this relation must hold that the one norm of epsilon is equal to the two norm of epsilon times this target probability p times the scaling. And if you found this epsilon, we have this query complexity. We showed that this is optimal, this epsilon vector, by solving an SDP. So we characterize the optimal epsilon vector, like what is the best way to perform these rotations. And that turns out to be an SDP. And then we could guess the solution and show that it's feasible, and its value is attained by a dual as well. So we know that this is actually optimal. So you cannot do better than this epsilon vector. That's all in the paper. You can find it on the archive. Okay, this is a very
great. Classical query complexity for Bent function is log n. Is that a fact or is that just a conjecture?
If you know the function f, yeah, it is n. It's very much like the Legendre symbol. It's pretty log. Okay, wait a second.
Yes.
Well, you must. I think you must have n. I think it should be n.
Yes.
Because you got to produce n bits of output too, right?
Yeah. What happens in between? And for now, you know, for searching, it has to be 2 to the power n.
Ah, okay. In the classical case, I have no clue. Actually, we wanted to include that in the paper, but I don't know. Do you know, Maurice? We looked at decision trees, but we couldn't figure out the. As far as I know, we couldn't figure out eventually. If you know something about that, that would be terrific. No setup. Okay, good. Any other questions? Okay, so this is a different approach. There is a reduction to hidden subgroup problem, and this reduction is particularly useful for the case of Bent functions. So it turns out that the Bent function case really reduces to an abelian hidden subgroup problem. So everybody might say, oh, boring, right? That's why I say it now after half an hour. But this actually makes sense for a more general class of functions. So you don't have to do it for Bent alone. And if you do it for functions over higher dimension hypercubes, say over Z3 to the n, this reduction to abelian hidden subgroup will no longer be true. And you will get really semi-direct products, so we will have a non-abelian hidden subgroup problem to solve. So in the case of Bent functions, it turns out that you can define a non-classical hiding function. So your hiding function is this function. It has a quantum output. So for each input x, you produce a quantum state. It turns out but that's essentially a classical function because orthogonal inputs will lead to orthogonal outputs. I owe that to a referee. Maybe the referee is in this room. Thanks. I didn't know that, and the referee pointed it out in an earlier submission, and it really helped to clean that thing up a lot, because now there is a nice reduction to an abelian hidden subgroup problem. You just set up three registers like this, evaluate the function g controlled and f controlled, which can be done if you have an oracle for that. You can implement these controlled oracles, and then at the end you measure this, and this will collect information about the hidden shift. Essentially, you get stuff that's perpendicular to the vector 1 comma f. Right? In each run, you will pick up a vector that's perpendicular to this, and then it will just proceed like Simon's algorithm to reconstruct s after roughly n samples. Oh, okay, the nice thing here is you don't need to know f star. Right? In the previous algorithm, you had to know f star to correlate it. Here, you don't have to do that. You just need to know what is f and the shifted one, and then you can run this algorithm. Okay, this can be simplified, actually. It's not needed. The second register is not needed. You can even do it with a circuit like this. And then the states you produce from that circuit, they look like this. And you can see here now why this is useful, because you just measure a u. You will only measure such u's for which u times s is 0. Right? All the other ones are not there. But you won't sample them uniformly. You have some kind of a priori distribution over all u's. In case of Bent, that's a flat distribution, so you might as well forget about it if you sample. But if it's, for instance, again, the Grover problem, you have a huge bias on 0. You basically always measure 0 here, and that's useless for identifying S. Right? So in order to produce one sample that's useful in the search case, you have to do it roughly 2 to the n times. That's probably what I was thinking for before for the other algorithm, because if you just run that really for the search problem, you will get an algorithm with query complexity 2 to the n and no squared speed up. Okay, but this is nevertheless useful For random functions, it turns out that this algorithm gives an efficient algorithm to find S. So random function, here's a random function. Well, I just pick one on a certain length. The spectrum looks like this. And well, very roughly speaking, that looks pretty flat. So we can do just the same trick as the Simon algorithm, really. Just sample from the spectrum, generate a system of linear equations, and continue doing until you have full rank. And then you identified S. It turns out to analyze this procedure, how long it will take actually till we have determined S uniquely, like until when do we have to sample so we have full rank. It's useful to look at these influences of strings. So the influence is like, it tells you the probability that the function value will flip when you shift it. If you know all these influences, then you can bound the expected number of queries it will take by this. So if your influences are all constant, then you will get an efficient algorithm. It turns out if you take, for instance, search, the influences are not all constant. But in case of bent functions, you just get like O of n out here. And we have sort of an average case exponential separation. What does it mean? Well, average case means we can pick a random function. It has to be in a black box, but it's a random function. And it will lead to an exponential separation to the classical case, because classically it can be shown that the query complexity is exponential. If both F and G are in a box, the classical query complexity is exponential. As Wim mentioned, like if you know F, right, it's not exponential in general. You can have, like in bent case, it can be much lower, it can be like N. But if both functions are in a box, the query complexity typically is high, because you can fool the classical algorithm quite easily by changing the S without the classical algorithm knowing. Okay, finally, I want to mention recent stuff that's the PGM approach. It's very similar to the hidden subgroup case. In hidden subgroups, it pays off a lot. If you look at multi-register experiments, they typically contain more information about the hidden subgroup than just single-register experiment. Okay? So actually, that's the only way we know to show that there is enough information at all in the hiding functions about F, is to take certain tensor powers of the coset states and to argue that they're almost orthogonal, so there must be enough information in them to identify the hidden subgroup. As far as I know, that's the only way to know that we can actually identify H. And a similar thing we want to do here, we have not succeeded yet in turning that into a fully efficient algorithm. But the idea is to, like, instead of producing that state here only once, to produce it t times, and then perform the PGM on that, and hopefully the PGM will be a good measurement to distinguish the states. Essentially, for each S, we will get a state, take it to the same power of t, and the hope is that state distinction for these mixed states, well, they turn out to be pure states, really, but we want to distinguish them. Hopefully, the PGM will be good. PGM turns out we have these just rank one elements in here, if you work it out, and it has these vectors, they look very innocent, but they live in a very high dimensional space. The only good thing about them is that we can say what their two norms are. So it turns out the two norms of these vectors, they behave quite nicely. So if you take if you look at your original spectrum of the function f, and it will have a spectrum f hat. It's not shown here, the spectrum, by the way, but if you take the function, it computes its convolution with itself and look at the spectrum of that guy, that's shown here. Okay, take the kind of the autocorrelation and look at that spectrum, and then you can raise that to some power and then compute a Fourier transform. So that's shown here for the case t equals 1, it's the blue stuff, and red is if you choose t equals 2. So what happens is that this becomes very quickly very, very flat. That's a nice property. We want to leverage that somehow, but so far we couldn't. Well, ideally, we'd like to say, yeah, this becomes now very flat, so we can just ignore it, and then we have a state from which we can just extract by one more Fourier transform. But so far, it hasn't worked out for some technical reasons. And hopefully, we have to know a little bit about the structure of these guys. I think we don't know enough. Yeah.
Is it that you're not sure if the PGM approach works, or is it that you do not know how to implement the DART?
Oh, yeah, we don't know how to implement it.
Because yeah. PGM should work, right?
Well, PGM is well defined. They are the vectors, right? We can write down what the vectors are, but we don't know how to rotate the basis. And we can work out the success probabilities, but we don't know how to implement. So we can show, for instance, there's always a T such that this will be nice, because what will happen is, if you look at that function f star f, that guy looks like this. It will f star f, for sure at 0 it is 1, because it's an autocorrelation. And we know also everywhere else we are bounded away from 1 by at least, say, it's 1 minus, I think it's actually 2 over 2 to the n. Okay, so all the other coefficients, they can be at most that big, provided that the function has no undetectable shifts. That's quite a mouthful, but it means like you can never have the situation that you cannot in principle detect the shift, right? You could have the situation that maybe for some particular value of s, this holds true, then you're sunk, because you might have the same value, you will get the same value in the other. Provided that does not happen, then if you raise that to the power t, right, then of course you will drop that down very quickly to a distribution which looks like this. And then taking the inverse Fourier transform will give you something flat, and then hopefully we'll be home and dry. But unfortunately, it's just the norms of this vector f s to the t scale like this. We don't know much about the structure of the vectors. In particular, we don't know if we can rotate the bases. Okay. So that will be the next step, I guess, to get a fully polynomial algorithm. Yeah, okay, that's it. Some open problems is, for instance, can we do that coherently? That sampling approach I mentioned, is it possible to maybe remove that thing? But, well, one should not have high hopes to do that in general. That must depend a lot on the function f itself, because otherwise you could do counting, sort of, right? Because if you could compute a Fourier transform, you would really have to compute it here. And that's supposedly difficult, right? Because there are these 2 to the n things you need to add together to compute even one Fourier coefficient. But maybe there are some functions for which this can be done, if the function is kind of benign. There's probably some relation to these problems that's got defined, but I still don't know exactly how that's related. The PGM approach, hopefully we can make it work someday. And ultimately, hopefully, we can apply that to some interesting crypto questions. Again, here we haven't had any success. And maybe, if we're a little bit pessimistic and unlucky, maybe it all really relates to the cyclic case. And the cyclic case is a dihedral case, and then maybe not much can be done. But hopefully the groups that arise for hidden shift problems will have a different structure. Yeah, that's it. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Martin. Do you have any more questions, Martin?
So is there much known about the analog of bent functions for, instead of over z to the n, but other...
for large n?
Say the cyclic group, the standard discrete Fourier transform, is it known what sorts of functions that there?
For large n? Or,
yeah.
It will depend on n. If it's a p, then yeah, there is something known, like generalized bent functions. But it quickly gets very tricky, because the notion of being bent, and the notion of, like, bent in the sense that your spectrum is flat, right? That's the important property that we exploited here. There's another property of the function which is so-called balancedness, and that's a property in the time domain, that you take kind of all values the same time. So if you, how can I say? So a function is balanced if you have, it goes from domain A to B, and now as you range over A, you will see all the elements of B the same number of times. That's what balance means. So if you look at so-called derivatives, so you can look at, say, this derivative by alpha, that's defined at position x, it is just f of x minus f of x plus alpha, right? It's like a discrete derivative. In the case of a bent function, it's going to be balanced for each derivative. Whatever derivative you take of f, it's going to be a balanced function. In the higher p case, it's no longer true. So you can have any such balance function gives you a flat function, but not all flat functions actually arise from balance functions. That kind of intuitively makes it a little bit harder to construct these guys. That's really the property we want to have. That's maybe the property that combinatorialists can figure out by some funny constructions using some designs or so. So it goes, it kind of, these two things branch out even for P, for prime. I don't know anything about Zn, to be honest. I don't know. Did you guys think, I thought you and Steve, you guys, I heard some rumors you guys thought about this, or
yeah.
No? Okay. For Zn case or for Zn to the D? Okay. Oh, that would be the dihedral case if you would translate it back. Okay. I think it would be an interesting problem to look at some maybe just larger than 2, but raise it to some power D for some D and let D be the input parameter. That could lead potentially to situations that are similar to this paper by Santa, Manier, Sen, or we forgot some authors, Friedel. They looked at some stuff like this, like semi-direct products of this type, right? But this was bounded even, like for bounded P, and N was the input parameter. Maybe that stuff can be related to this too in some way. But I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know.
Any more questions? Let's thank Martin again.